This is audiobook of The History of Spiritualism by Arthur Conan Doyle. First published 1926. Preface. This work has grown from small disconnected chapters into a narrative which covers in a way the whole history of the spiritualistic movement. This genesis needs some little explanation. I had written certain studies with no particular ulterior object save to gain myself, and to pass on to others, a clear view of what seemed to me to be important episodes in the modern spiritual development of the human race. These included the chapters on Swedenborg, on Irving, on A.J. Davis, on the Hydesville incident, on the history of the Fox sisters, on the Eddies, and on the life of D.D. Home. These were all done before it was suggested to my mind that I had already gone some distance in doing a fuller history of the spiritualistic movement than had hitherto seen the light, a history which would have the advantage of being written from the inside and with intimate personal knowledge of those factors which are characteristic of this modern development. It is indeed curious that this movement, which many of us regard as the most important in the history of the world since the Christ episode, has never had a historian from those who were within it, and who had large personal experience of its development. Mr. Frank Podmore brought together a large number of the facts, and, by ignoring those which did not suit his purpose, endeavored to suggest the worthlessness of most of the rest, especially the physical phenomena, which in his view were mainly the result of fraud. There is a history of spiritualism by Mr. McCabe which turns everything to fraud, and which is itself a misnomer, since the public would buy a book with such a title under the impression that it was a serious record instead of a travesty. There is also a history by J. Arthur Hill which is written from a strictly psychic research point of view, and is far behind the real provable facts. Then we have modern American spiritualism, a 20 years record, and 19th century miracles, by that great woman and splendid propagandist, Mrs. Emma Harding Britton, but these deal only with phases, though they are exceedingly valuable. Finally and best of all, there is Man's Survival After Death, by the Reverend Charles L. Tweedale, but this is rather a very fine connected exposition of the truth of the cult than a deliberate consecutive history. There are general histories of mysticism, like those of Enomosa and Howitt, but there is no clean, cut, comprehensive story of the successive developments of this world wide movement. Just before going to press, a book has appeared by Campbell, Holmes, which is a very useful compendium of psychic facts, as its title, The Facts of Psychic Science and Philosophy, implies, but here again it cannot claim to be a connected history. It was clear that such a work needed a great deal of research, far more than I in my crowded life could devote to it. It is true that my time was in any case dedicated to it, but the literature is vast, and there were many aspects of the movement which claimed my attention. Under these circumstances I claimed and obtained the loyal assistance of Mr. W. Leslie Gurnow, whose knowledge of the subject and whose industry have proved to be invaluable. He has dug assiduously into that vast quarry, he has separated out the ore from the rubbish, and in every way he has been of the greatest assistance. I had originally expected no more than raw material, but he has occasionally given me the finished article, of which I have gladly availed myself, altering it only to the extent of getting my own personal point of view. I cannot admit too fully the loyal assistance which he has given me, and if I have not conjoined his name with my own upon the title page, it is for reasons which he understands and in which he acquiesces. Arthur Conan Doyle. Chapter 1. The Story of Swedenborg. It is impossible to give any date for the early appearances of external intelligent power of a higher or lower type impinging upon the affairs of men. Spiritualists are in the habit of taking March 31, 1848, as the beginning of all psychic things, because their own movement dates from that day. There has, however, been no time in the recorded history of the world when we do not find traces of preternatural interference and a tardy recognition of them from humanity. The only difference between these episodes and the modern movement is that the former might be described as a case of stray wanderers from some further sphere, while the latter bears the sign of a purposeful and organized invasion. But as an invasion might well be preceded by the appearance of pioneers who search out the land, so the spirit influx of recent years was heralded by a number of incidents which might well be traced to the Middle Ages or beyond them. Some term must be fixed for a commencement of the narrative, and perhaps no better one can be found than the story of the great Swedish seer, Emanuel Swedenborg, who has some claim to be the father of our new knowledge of supernal matters. When the first rays of the rising sun of spiritual knowledge fell upon the earth, they illuminated the greatest and highest human mind before they shed their light on lesser men. That mountain peak of mentality was this great religious reformer and clairvoyant medium, as little understood by his own followers as ever the Christ has been. In order fully to understand Swedenborg, one would need to have a Swedenborg brain, and that has not met with once in a century. And yet by our power of comparison and our experience of facts of which Swedenborg knew nothing, we can realize some part of his life more clearly than he could himself. The object of this study is not to treat the man as a whole, but to endeavor to place him in the general scheme of psychic unfolding treated in this work, from which his own church in its narrowness would withhold him. Swedenborg was a contradiction in some ways to our psychic generalizations, for it has been the habit to say that great intellect stands in the way of personal psychic experience. The clean slate is certainly most apt for the writing of a message. Swedenborg's mind was no clean slate, but was criss-crossed with every kind of exact learning which mankind is capable of acquiring. Never was there such a concentration of information. He was primarily a great mining engineer and authority on metallurgy. He was a military engineer who helped to turn the fortunes of one of the many campaigns of Charles XII of Sweden. He was a great authority upon astronomy and physics, the author of learned works upon the tides and the determination of latitude. He was a zoologist and an anatomist. He was a financier and political economist who anticipated the conclusions of Adam Smith. Finally, he was a profound biblical student who had sucked in theology with his mother's milk, and lived in the stern evangelical atmosphere of a Lutheran pastor during the most impressionable years of his life. His psychic development, which occurred when he was 55, in no way interfered with his mental activity, and several of his scientific pamphlets were published after that date. With such a mind, it is natural enough that he should be struck by the evidence for extra mundane powers which comes in the way of every thoughtful man, but what is not natural is that he should himself be the medium for such powers. There is a sense in which his mentality was actually detrimental and vitiated his results, and there was another in which it was to the highest degree useful. To illustrate this, one has to consider the two categories into which his work may be divided. The first is the theological. This seems to most people outside the chosen flock a useless and deep perilous side of his work. On the one hand, he accepts the Bible as being in a very particular sense the work of God. Upon the other, he contends that its true meaning is entirely different from its obvious meaning, and that it is he, and only he, who, by the help of angels, is able to give the true meaning. Such a claim is intolerable. The infallibility of the Pope would be a trifle compared with the infallibility of Swedenborg if such a position were admitted. The Pope is at least only infallible when giving his verdict on points of doctrine ex cathedra with his cardinals around him. Swedenborg's infallibility would be universal and unrestricted. Nor do his explanations in the least commend themselves to one's reason. When, in order to get at the true sense of a God-given message, one has to suppose that a horse signifies intellectual truth, an ass signifies scientific truth, a flame signifies improvement, and on through countless symbols, we seem to be in a realm of make-believe which can only be compared with the ciphers which some ingenious critics have detected in the plays of Shakespeare. Not thus does God send his truth into the world. If such a view were accepted, the Swedenborgian creed could only be the mother of a thousand heresies, and we should find ourselves back again amid the hair splittings and the syllogisms of the mediaeval schoolmen. All great and true things are simple and intelligible. Swedenborg's theology is neither simple nor intelligible, and that is its condemnation. When, however, we get behind his tireless exegesis of the scriptures, where everything means something different from what it obviously means, and when we get at some of the general results of his teaching, they are not in harmonious with liberal modern thought or with the teaching which has been received from the other side since spiritual communication became open. Thus the general proposition that this world is a laboratory of souls, a forcing ground where the material refines out the spiritual, is not to be disputed. He rejects the Trinity in its ordinary sense, but rebuilds it in some extraordinary sense which would be equally objectionable to a Unitarian. He admits that every system has its divine purpose and that virtue is not confined to Christianity. He agrees with the spiritualist teaching in seeking the true meaning of Christ's life in its power as an example, and he rejects atonement and original sin. He sees the root of all evil in selfishness, yet he admits that a healthy egoism, as Hegel called it, is essential. In sexual matters his theories are liberal to the verge of laxity. A church he considered an absolute necessity, as if no individual could arrange his own dealings with his Creator. Altogether, it is such a jumble of ideas, poured forth at such length in so many great Latin volumes, and expressed in so obscure a style, that every independent interpreter of it would be liable to found a new religion of his own. Not in that direction does the worth of Swedenborg lie. That worth is really to be found in his psychic powers and in his psychic information, which would have been just as valuable had no word of theology ever come from his pen. It is these powers and that information to which we will now turn. Even as a lad, young Swedenborg had visionary moments, but the extremely practical and energetic manhood which followed submerged that more delicate side of his nature. It came occasionally to the surface, however, all through his life, and several instances have been put on record which show that he possessed those powers which are usually called traveling clairvoyance, where the soul appears to leave the body, to acquire information at a distance, and to return with news of what is occurring elsewhere. It is a not uncommon attribute of mediums, and can be matched by a thousand examples among spiritualistic sensitives, but it is rare in people of intellect, and rare also when accompanied by an apparently normal state of the body while the phenomenon is proceeding. Thus, in the oft-quoted example of Gothenburg, where the seer observed and reported on a fire in Stockholm, 300 miles away, with perfect accuracy, he was at a dinner party with 16 guests, who made valuable witnesses. The story was investigated by no less a person than the philosopher Kant, who was a contemporary. These occasional incidents were, however, merely the signs of latent powers which came to full fruition quite suddenly in London in April of the year 1744. It may be remarked that though the seer was of a good Swedish family and was elevated to the Swedish nobility, it was none the less in London that his chief books were published, that his illumination was begun and finally that he died and was buried. From the day of his first vision he continued until his death, 27 years later, to be in constant touch with the other world. The same night the world of spirits, hell and heaven, were convincingly open to me, where I found many persons of my acquaintance of all conditions. Thereafter the Lord daily opened the eyes of my spirit to see in perfect wakefulness what was going on in the other world, and to converse, broad awake, with angels and spirits. In his first vision Swedenborg speaks of a kind of vapor steaming from the pores of my body. It was a most visible watery vapor and fell downwards to the ground upon the carpet. This is a close description of that ectoplasm which we have found to be the basis of all physical phenomena. The substance has also been called ideoplasm, because it takes on in an instant any shape with which it is impressed by the spirit. In this case it changed, according to his account, into vermin, which was said to be a sign from his guardians that they disapproved of his diet, and was accompanied by a clairaudient warning that he must be more careful in that respect. What can the world make of such a narrative? They may say that the man was mad, but his life in the years which followed showed no sign of mental weakness. Or they might say that he lied. but he was a man who was famed for his punctilious veracity. His friend Cuno, a banker of Amsterdam, said of him, "When he gazed upon me with his smiling blue eyes, it was as if truth itself was speaking from them." Was he then self, deluded and honestly mistaken? We have to face the fact that in the main the spiritual observations which he made have been confirmed and extended since his time by innumerable psychic observers. The true verdict is that he was the first, and in many ways the greatest of the whole line of mediums, that he was subject to the errors as well as to the privileges which mediumship brings, that only by the study of mediumship can his powers be really understood, and that in endeavoring to separate him from spiritualism his new church has shown a complete misapprehension of his gifts, and of their true place in the general scheme of nature. As a great pioneer of the spiritual movement, his position is both intelligible and glorious. As an isolated figure with incomprehensible powers, there is no place for him in any broad comprehensive scheme of religious thought. It is interesting to note that he considered his powers to be intimately connected with a system of respiration. Air and ether being all around us, it is as if some men could breathe more ether and less air and so attain a more etheric state. This, no doubt, is a crude and clumsy way of putting it, but some such idea runs through the work of many schools of psychic thought. Lawrence Oliphant, who had no obvious connection with Swedenborg, wrote his book in order to explain it. The Indian system of yoga depends upon the same idea. But anyone who has seen an ordinary medium go into trance is aware of the peculiar hissing intakes with which the process begins and the deep expirations with which it ends. A fruitful field of study lies there for the science of the future. Here, as in other psychic matters, caution is needed. The author has known several cases where tragic results have followed upon an ignorant use of deep, breathing psychic exercises. Spiritual, like electrical power, has its allotted use, but needs some knowledge and caution in handling. Swedenborg sums up the matter by saying that when he communed with spirits he would for an hour at a time hardly draw a breath, taking in only enough air to serve as a supply to his thoughts. Apart from this peculiarity of respiration, Swedenborg was normal during his visions, though he naturally preferred to be secluded at such times. He seems to have been privileged to examine the other world through several of its spheres, and though his theological habit of mind may have tinctured his descriptions, on the other hand the vast range of his material knowledge gave him unusual powers of observation and comparison. Let us see what were the main facts which he brought back from his numerous journeys, and how far they coincide with those which have been obtained since his day by psychic methods. He found, then, that the other world, to which we all go after death, consisted of a number of different spheres representing various shades of luminosity and happiness, each of us going to that for which our spiritual condition has fitted us. We are judged in automatic fashion, like going to like by some spiritual law, and the result being determined by the total result of our life, so that absolution or a death, bed repentance can be of little avail. He found in these spheres that the scenery and conditions of this world were closely reproduced, and so also was the general framework of society. He found houses in which families lived, temples in which they worshipped, halls in which they assembled for social purposes, palaces in which rulers might dwell. Death was made easy by the presence of celestial beings who helped the new comer into his fresh existence. Such new comers had an immediate period of complete rest. They regained consciousness in a few days of our time. There were both angels and devils, but they were not of another order to ourselves. They were all human beings who had lived on earth and who were either undeveloped souls, as devils, or highly developed souls, as angels. We did not change in any way at death. Man lost nothing by death, but was still a man in all respects, though more perfect than when in the body. He took with him not only his powers but also his acquired modes of thought, his beliefs and his prejudices. All children were received equally, whether baptized or not. They grew up in the other world. Young women mothered them until the real mother came across. There was no eternal punishment. Those who were in the hells could work their way out if they had the impulse. Those in the heavens were also in no permanent place, but were working their way to something higher. There was marriage in the form of spiritual union in the next world. It takes a man and a woman to make a complete human unit. Swedenborg, it may be remarked, was never married in life. There was no detail too small for his observation in the spirit spheres. He speaks of the architecture, the artisan's work, the flowers and fruits, the scribes, the embroidery, the art, the music, the literature, the science, the schools, the museums, the colleges, the libraries and the sports. It may all shock conventional minds, though why harps, crowns and thrones should be tolerated and other less material things denied, it is hard to see. Those who left this world old, decrepit, diseased, or deformed, renewed their youth, and gradually assumed their full vigor. Married couples continued together if their feelings towards each other were close and sympathetic. If not, the marriage was dissolved. Two real lovers are not separated by the death of one, since the spirit of the deceased dwells with the spirit of the survivor, and this even to the death of the latter, when they again meet and are reunited, and love each other more tenderly than before. Such are some gleanings out of the immense store of information which God sent to the world through Swedenborg. Again and again they have been repeated by the mouths and the pens of our own spiritualistic illuminates. The world has so far disregarded it, and clung to outworn and senseless conceptions. Gradually the new knowledge is making its way, however, and when it has been entirely accepted, the true greatness of the mission of Swedenborg will be recognized, while his biblical exegesis will be forgotten. The new church, which was formed in order to sustain the teaching of the Swedish master, has allowed itself to become a backwater instead of keeping its rightful place as the original source of psychic knowledge. When the spiritualistic movement broke out in 1848, and when men like Andrew Jackson Davis supported it with philosophic writings and psychic powers which can hardly be distinguished from those of Swedenborg, the new church would have been well advised to hail this development as being on the lines indicated by their leader. Instead of doing so, they have preferred, for some reason which is difficult to understand, to exaggerate every point of difference and ignore every point of resemblance, until the two bodies have drifted into a position of hostility. In point of fact, every spiritualist should honor Swedenborg, and his bust should be in every spiritualist temple, as being the first and greatest of modern mediums. On the other hand, the new church should sink any small differences and join heartily in the new movement, contributing their churches and organization to the common cause. It is difficult on examining Swedenborg's life to discover what are the causes which make his present-day followers look askance at other psychic bodies. What he did then is what they do now. Speaking of Palm's death, the seer says, "He died on Monday and spoke with me on Thursday. I was invited to the funeral. He saw the hearse and saw them let down the coffin into the grave. He conversed with me as it was going on, asking me why they had buried him when he was alive. When the priest pronounced that he would rise again at the day of judgment, he asked why this was, when he had risen already. He wondered that such a belief could obtain, considering that he was even now alive. This is entirely in accord with the experience of a present-day medium. If Swedenborg was within his rights, then the medium is so also. Again, Breyer was beheaded at 10 in the morning and spoke to me at 10 that night. He was with me almost without interruption for several days." Such instances show that Swedenborg had no more scruples about converse with the dead than the Christ had when he spoke on the mountain with Moses and Elias. Swedenborg has laid down his own view very clearly, but in considering it one has to remember the time in which he lived and his want of experience of the trend and object of the new revelation. This view was that God, for good and wise purposes, had separated the world of spirits from ours, and that communication was not granted except for cogent reasons, among which mere curiosity should not be counted. Every earnest student of the psychic would agree with it, and every earnest spiritualist is averse from turning the most solemn thing upon earth into a sort of pastime. As to having a cogent reason, our main reason is that in such an age of materialism as Swedenborg can never have imagined, we are endeavoring to prove the existence and supremacy of spirit in so objective a way that it will meet and beat the materialists on their own ground. It would be hard to imagine any reason more cogent than this, and therefore we have every right to claim that if Swedenborg were now living he would have been a leader in our modern psychic movement. Some of his followers, notably Dr. Garth Wilkinson, have put forward another objection thus: the danger of man in speaking with spirits is that we are all in association with our likes, and being full of evil these similar spirits, could we face them, would but confirm us in our own state of views. To this we can only reply that though it is specious, it is proved by experience to be false. Man is not naturally bad. The average human being is good. The mere act of spiritual communication in its solemnity brings out the religious side. Therefore, as a rule, it is not the evil but the good influence which is encountered, as the beautiful and moral records of stances will show. The author can testify that in nearly 40 years of psychic work, during which he has attended innumerable stances in many lands, he has never on any single occasion heard an obscene word or any message which could offend the ears of the most delicate female. Other veteran spiritualists bring the same testimony. Therefore, while it is undoubtedly true that evil spirits are attracted to an evil circle, in actual practice it is a very rare thing for anyone to be incommoded thereby. When such spirits come, the proper procedure is not to repulse them, but rather to reason gently with them and so endeavor to make them realize their own condition and what they should do for self-improvement. This has occurred many times within the author's personal experience and with the happiest results. Some little personal account of Swedenborg may fitly end this brief review of his doctrines, which is primarily intended to indicate his position in the general scheme. He must have been a most frugal, practical, hard, working and energetic young man, and a most lovable old one. Life seems to have mellowed him into a very gentle and venerable creature. He was placid, serene, and ever ready for conversation which did not take a psychic turn unless his companions so desired. The material of such conversations was always remarkable, but he was afflicted with a stammer which hindered his enunciation. In person he was tall and spare, with a spiritual face, blue eyes, a wig to his shoulders, dark clothing, knee, breeches, buckles, and a cane. Swedenborg claimed that a heavy cloud was formed round the earth by the psychic grossness of humanity, and that from time to time there was a judgment and a clearing up, even as the thunderstorm clears the material atmosphere. He saw that the world, even in his day, was drifting into a dangerous position owing to the unreason of the churches on the one side and the reaction towards absolute want of religion which was caused by it. Modern psychic authorities, notably Veilhoen, have spoken of this ever-accumulating cloud, and there is a very general feeling that the necessary cleansing process will not be long postponed. A notice of Swedenborg from the spiritualistic standpoint may be best concluded by an extract from his own diary. He says, "All confirmations in matters pertaining to theology are, as it were, glued just into the brains, and can with difficulty be removed, and while they remain, genuine truths can find no place." He was a very great seer, a great pioneer of psychic knowledge, and his weakness lay in those very words which he has written. The general reader who desires to go further will find Swedenborg's most characteristic teachings in his Arcana Codestia. His life has been admirably done by Garth Wilkinson, Troppridge, and Brayley Hodgetts, the present president of the English Swedenborg Society. In spite of all his theological symbolism, his name must live eternally as the first of all modern men who has given a description of the process of death, and of the world beyond, which is not founded upon the vague ecstatic and impossible visions of the old churches, but which actually corresponds with the descriptions which we ourselves obtain from those who endeavor to convey back to us some clear idea of their new existence. Chapter 2, Edward Irving, The Shakers, the story of Edward Irving and his experience of spiritual manifestations in the years from 1830 to 1833 are of great interest to the psychic student, and helped to bridge the gap between Swedenborg on one side and Andrew Jackson Davis on the other.